It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin project aims to understand the roots of prejudice and stereotypes and help us overcome them in our daily lives. The director of the UW-Madison Prejudice Lab joins the show.
First, former FBI Director James Comey will testify in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow. After he was fired last month, the testimony is expected to be a major political event. News networks across the country will be interrupting regular programming to broadcast it, including WPR, which will be airing the testimony from 9 until noon.
That's not the only controversy surrounding the White House this week. President Trump recently picked a fight on Twitter, this time with the mayor of London, which was the target of a terrorist attack.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
Well, former FBI Director James Comey, as we said, will testify tomorrow before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And this is shaping up to be a huge media event, even though the pages of his testimony have been released already. But you have TV networks covering this. Why is this considered such a big deal?
You know, every once in a while we get one of these kind of moments of high drama in Washington. You know, a hearing is kind of a showdown. It's theatrical. You have a bank of senators grilling, you know, a lone witness. That creates some drama. You have, this amazing political context in the case of a relatively new president who is operating amid incredible turmoil and turbulence and controversy. And you have the FBI, the former FBI director that he fired amid all these questions swirling around about investigations of Russia's efforts to meddle in our elections. You have questions, allegations of obstruction of justice. And you had the release, unusual release a day ahead of time by the Senate Intelligence Committee of former FBI Director Comey's testimony, which is kind of fueling the anticipation. And I think tomorrow, it's not just whatever bombshells may or may not emerge from the testimony, but it's just the sheer kind of theater and drama of it, what people take away from it in terms of Comey's credibility and what they take away from it in terms of the picture he paints of his relationship and his interactions with his president.
And this testimony is going to go on with the backdrop, Craig, of supposedly the president planning to watch, apparently maybe tweeting responses as it goes, and then a nonprofit group friendly to President Trump is planning to run ads attacking James Comey as a showboat and a Washington insider while this is going on.
Yeah, it's this sort of three-dimensional political conflict. There were going to be people in my profession sort of watching the testimony while they're glued to their Twitter feed to see how President Trump is reacting to the testimony and how people are reacting to his reactions. I mean, it's just classic kind of Washington circa 2017. It kind of makes your head explode in some respects, but it is high drama, and it's going to be a very unusual day.
So we have Comey's prepared testimony already. So what are the big question marks that linger over this event tomorrow?
Well, part of it is just going to be, we're going to hear from senators in both parties and get a sense of how they are, how they interpret his narrative. Whether they see the events as he has described them, as how concerning they see this set of facts or set of this version of events, how bothered are they by the picture it paints of the requests that President Trump is making or was making of his FBI director. I mean, to hear former FBI Director Comey tell it, President Trump, there were a lot of asks here. He was asking him to essentially back off the investigation of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. He was asking for his personal loyalty. He was asking him to lift the cloud over whether the Russian investigation was targeting the president personally. There were a lot of asks, and there was notably Comey's reaction, which is one of feeling incredibly awkward and feeling like the exchanges themselves were inappropriate and rushing off to take notes on them all for that reason after each one of them, and asking the attorney general to prevent the president from meeting with him privately again for that reason. So, everybody walks away from these hearings and these confrontations with a sense of how credible is the person, is the witness, in this case, FBI Director Comey, and does the picture he paints ring true to them about the events? And that's what tomorrow's going to be about.
Talking to Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the big stories from the week in Washington. Craig, before we move on from testimony, this all comes after today's testimony before the Senate from top intelligence officials. Supposed to be on other stuff, but a lot of these things came up, and some of the officials declined to answer questions about their personal conversations with the president, saying they didn't necessarily cite legal reasons, but they said they felt uncomfortable sharing that information, got kind of testy with the senators sometime. Did anything big come out of today?
I think you pointed to the interesting part of what happened today, which is that while these intelligence officials said that they, didn't feel anything happened, that they didn't feel they were placed under undue pressure in these investigations, they would not answer specific questions about their communications with the president and what was asked of them. This is, one of the consequences of the appointment of the special counsel. And some people may feel that that these officials are using that as a crutch to avoid answering questions, but the fact is that it's going to inhibit the information we get out of public hearings, and we get the public information we get out of the congressional investigations because of the nature of the FBI investigation being overseen by the special counsel. So there are going to be some frustrated members of the public, but there are also going to be some frustrated senators in both parties.
Moving on, against the backdrop of these fairly dramatic hearings on Capitol Hill, we have the president announcing his pick for new FBI director, Christopher Wray. What do we know about him?
I think he's seen as a fairly non-controversial pick because he's somebody with a background in law enforcement as opposed to, a personal ally of President Trump or a, super partisan figure. So in that sense, President Trump did something non-controversial with disappointment. It doesn't, the special counsel's investigation will go on. And that's an investigation where that will enjoy, a measure of independence vis-a-vis the new FBI director. But I think the key takeaway here is that it was a pick that doesn't add fuel to the fire.
And with what Comey had to say about the president pressuring him to say he would be loyal to the president, people have been speculating that when Christopher Wray comes before the Senate, that's going to be at the top of people's list. Did the president condition this appointment on some kind of promise of loyalty? Do you think that's going to be an issue?
Well, I guess that depends on the answer, but I think I can't imagine someone taking the job under those circumstances with those kinds of conditions, especially given the traditions associated with this.
And the FBI director position is a nonpartisan position, but do you see any sort of change in the shape of that or the way that appointment is lined up given the circumstances and President Trump's desire, seemingly at least, for loyalty?
Well, I think it's worth noting that that the special counsel is himself a former FBI director who enjoys a lot of stature in both parties. And so that gives him a measure of independence regardless of who's running the FBI. I don't think there's any evidence at this point that this would kind of inhibit the investigation in that sense.
Craig Gilbert is with us right now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're recapping some of the biggest stories in national politics this week.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you looking for in James Comey's testimony coming up tomorrow? Have you read the preview of his testimony? What did you think? Do you believe the president tried to pressure him or obstruct the Russia investigation? What do you think of the new pick for the head of the FBI? And how about the Twitter exchange between the president and the mayor of London after terrorist attacks there? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're looking at the week in Washington with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you going to watch James Comey's testimony tomorrow in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee? What are you looking for? What do you think of what you've read so far? He previewed that testimony. And what was your reaction to President Trump's tweets about the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, after the terrorist attack over there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Craig, after the attacks in London, President Trump appeared to misconstrue a statement made by the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, about a cause for alarm and in a way to mock him. And that sort of sparked this bit of a Twitter war. And now the mayor of London saying that the city should not roll out the red carpet for Trump. What's the latest there?
Well, I mean, it is kind of bizarre and strange to have the president of the United States feuding with a mayor in another country, albeit a major world capital. But you know, one of the problems I think for the president with these exchanges is that it creates kind of a political dynamic in other countries that I think works against him, which is that. You know, as a result, for example, of this exchange with the mayor of London, it places the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, under greater pressure vis-a-vis her own relationship to Trump. She's kind of expected to come to defend her fellow Brit, the mayor, and criticize Donald Trump, which she doesn't really want to do, which she doesn't have to. And it's interesting. It's one of several cases that we've seen recently where the president's, kind of these dust-ups with the president has the potential to kind of affect domestic politics in another country and not in a good way for the United States.
And that raises the question of how to treat the president's tweets. And we've had presidential spokesperson Kellyanne Conway saying, the press obsesses too much over the president's tweets. Don't pay him so much mind. And then Sean Spicer, presidential spokesperson, says Trump's tweets are official presidential statements. So what does the press do with that then? How do we cover that?
And not to mention the fact that the president himself has called attention to his tweets and to the importance of his tweets and to the importance of that as an outlet for him to communicate. So I think you have to sort of take the president at his word and view them as as actual, I don't know if official or formal is the right word, but these are statements and communications that represent kind of what the president thinks and what he's trying to communicate and what he wants to communicate. So by definition, they're extremely newsworthy.
When you take a major public figure, and in this case, in this country, there's probably no more major figure than the president. But if you look at, say, celebrity accounts, a lot of the times you don't know if it's the celebrity themselves who's doing the tweeting or if someone else is managing their account and they're just signing off on it. But in this case, I mean, are we assuming flat out that these tweets are coming directly from the hand of the president of the United States?
I think that's a pretty good assumption because, for one reason, we know that the people around him would prefer he not be doing this because it makes it not only complicates the politics around the White House, but it makes their lives a lot more difficult in many, many ways because then they have to respond to the tweets. It also, as we've seen in the past, has the potential to undermine their own spin about the president's actions. And so in every possible way, They would prefer that the president tone it down. And I think for that reason alone, I think we can be confident that these are authentic communications from the president. And this is not, you know, it doesn't represent what his staff thinks he should be saying. It represents what he either can't help himself from saying or what he chooses to say.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi. I think from what I've observed of the president that he can't bear not to be the center of attention. And so that's part of why he will be tweeting simultaneously. And I also, from everything I've heard, that he has a short attention span. So it's not like he could wait until the 3 hours later and tweet, that he has to do it almost at the same time. So that's my view.
Okay, thanks. So live tweeting during the Comey testimony, and there's been apparently some reported concern from White House staff that this could be a legal problem. I mean, the president's tweets could interfere with the White House case on the travel ban executive order, in part by calling it a travel ban, which his staff hadn't been doing. This could get him into legal trouble if he tweets the wrong things during the Comey testimony. How big a concern is that for White House staff, Craig?
It is a concern. I mean, it's not, it's legal, it's diplomatic and international. I mean, we just had a case where involving Qatar and the Middle East, where other countries in the Middle East, other Arab countries, trying to isolate Qatar over its relationship with Iran, the president weighing in on Twitter and seeming to take credit for this development when, in fact, we have a major military presence in this country. And so you have the potential for it not only to kind of create mischief when it comes to legal controversies involving the executive branch, but also when it comes to diplomatic issues, and not to mention the politics. So on every level, I mean, there is a reason why presidents tend to communicate in very controlled ways. It certainly makes sense when you think about how diplomacy is practiced and when you think about how the legal system works. And this, you know, is just kind of like a huge disruptive force in all of that.
Craig Gilbert is with us right now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're getting the latest in national news. And Craig, you reported on a recent study that looked at who Wisconsin's most bipartisan federal lawmakers are. What'd you come up with?
There's a place called the Lugar Center, which looks at one particular aspect of legislating, which is to what extent the lawmakers work across party lines when they're introducing legislation, when they're co-sponsoring legislation. So if you're a lawmaker, you will score well on this index if you're a lawmaker that has introduced bills that have attracted support from members of the other party, or if you have in turn co-sponsored legislation introduced by members of the other party. The more you do that, the better you score in this index. Ron Kind, who's a moderate Democrat from southwestern Wisconsin, has scored the best in the last several years in the Wisconsin delegation by this measure, followed by Jim Sensenbrenner. What's interesting is that, you know, Ron Kind is a moderate and from a very competitive district. So, you know, it sort of makes sense in a political way that he would be trying to be bipartisan in this fashion. It's interesting that the next senator on the list is Jim Sensenbrenner, who's one of the most conservative members of the House and has a very one-sided district, but has been around for a very long time and is also known as kind of an institutionalist in the House. And he's forged a lot of kind of strange bedfellows coalitions with liberals on privacy issues and criminal justice issues and other things. And so those are the two senators, the two House members that sort of stand out in the delegation. Most of the remaining members of Congress from Wisconsin get negative ratings rather than positive ratings by this measure, although, you know, depending on which year you look at, their numbers bounce around a little bit.
I haven't looked at the report. I would guess that over time, bipartisanship has gone down by these ratings. Is there any historical evidence to back that up?
Absolutely. I mean, we have numbers for senators going back to the early 90s and for House members only going back a few years. But yes, they're capturing less bipartisan activity. At the same time that that's happening, at the same time as Congress has clearly become more polarized along party lines, so that you have, when it comes to the voting behavior of members of Congress, not just the writing of bills, when it comes to their actual voting behavior, the institutions have become a lot more polarized, where you have Democrats and Republicans voting with each other far less often. That's well documented by other people. Both these trends have gone kind of hand in hand, it's hard to imagine that abating anytime soon. I mean, this is the nature of kind of how Washington works these days.
And Craig, as we start to wrap up, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan has been doing some fundraising, seemingly trying to shore up the House for the midterm elections. What have we seen there?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that Paul Ryan has been incredibly effective at is raising money for his party when it comes to defending his House majorities. He's had to struggle on other fronts with his relationship with President Trump, with getting legislation passed. We saw the difficulties they went through in getting a health care bill passed and finally did. He's going to have trouble getting tax legislation. He's got his hands full. It's obviously the speakership's an incredibly challenging job. And even though Republicans have unified control in Washington, It's a party that has big divisions on policy, and he's dealing with a very unorthodox presidency, and it exacerbates some of these internal divisions within the Republican Party. But he has been very successful at raising money. He was successful, for that reason partly, and other reasons, in helping to contain the losses in the last election cycle. But he's going to have his work cut out for him in the next election cycle, because when the president is as unpopular as this president is in the current polling, if that continues, and another poll was out today which showed the president with only a 34% approval rating, that tends to spell trouble for his party in the congressional elections, and that's his big worry going into 2018.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and our weekly look at national politics. Issues of race and discrimination have been a big part of many of the top stories in the United States over the last few years, including police-involved shootings, disparities in education and income, the rise of the alt-right, incarceration reform, and more.
And the idea of implicit bias or unconscious bias has gotten a lot of attention, even made it into the presidential debate in last year's election.
A UW-Madison project is working to measure bias and stereotypes by race and gender and other categories and figure out how to help people overcome their prejudice. Patricia Devine is with us now in the studio. She's a professor of psychology and director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Well, how do you start to measure things like implicit or unconscious bias in a person?
Well, it started out as a rather tricky endeavor, and the hope was that we could get sort of straightforward measures of these types of biases. And so early in my career, we looked at sort of indirect indicators, just whether people said stereotypes popped to mind, or once a stereotype was activated, did it influence judgments of others? Say somebody doing an ambiguously hostile behavior and you had prime stereotypes of African Americans, it would lead to biased judgments, more hostility than if you had not primed those ideas or made them highly accessible. But in recent years, people have developed more direct indicators like the implicit association test, or IAT, that Tony Greenwald at the University of Washington developed some years ago. And basically, this is a reaction time measure that we call it a dual categorization task. You're looking at faces of black and white people and then positive and negative words, and you're sort of doing a sorting task. The bottom line is that as you go through this task, it gives you an indication of the strength of association between black and white people and positive and negatively valenced information. The typical pattern we see in white Americans in this country is that they more strongly associate white Americans with positive valenced information and black Americans with negative valenced information.
And then how do we see this kind of bias play out outside of the lab in the real world? How does this implicit bias that we may not be aware of manifest itself?
Yeah, so I like to talk about it as unintentional bias, right? I think that, to my mind, that's a clearer way to think about these kinds of issues. And let me tell you about a study that was done with gender as the context. And Moss Rakestan and their colleagues, they did an experiment where they took applications and randomly assigned male and female names to the applications and sent them out to STEM professors. So this is the science, technology, engineering, and math kind of professors. And they were interested in whether the identically credentialed male and female would receive different treatment, be less likely to be hired as a lab manager. So that was the position. It turns out it's an important position. It's your entry into the field. And what they found is that both male and female professors evaluated the male applicant more favorably, found him to be more competent, worthy of more mentoring, and worthy of a higher salary than the female applicant. Now, keep in mind, it's the exact same set of credentials.
The only difference is the name that sounds more like a male or a female.
That's right. Jane Doe, John Doe. You could think about it that way. So it's only that's the only difference across the applications. And most people believe that those professors were not intentionally discriminating against the women, that there is something about the stereotype that men are better at math and science than women that influenced their interpretation unintentionally, and they weren't really aware of that type of bias. And that's one of the ways in which it can play out. You see a similar type of phenomenon with black and white applications for jobs actually out in the world in Chicago and the Boston area. Bertrand and Melanathan showed that identically credentialed black versus white applications, you just changed the name, were 50% less likely to get callbacks. So they were less likely to get interviewed. If you don't get interviewed, you can't get the job. If you don't have the job, then you're not represented in the workforce. And again, most people attribute these things to the unintentional rather than the intentional form of bias.
And that, I think a lot of the way people talk about racism in particular, it's an either or. Either a person is a racist or the phrase often, they don't have a racist bone in their body. In fact, it sounds like most of us, probably all of us, have some kind of prejudice, aware of it, intended or not.
Well, let's call it a bias. Mm-hmm. All right. So I think that the way the either or is an oversimplification. What I would say is a lot of people sincerely embrace egalitarian values, but being socialized into our culture, they learn stereotypes very early in childhood, on the order of age, 3, 4, and 5. They're firmly ingrained. They're frequently activated, very well practiced, and they end up being the default, or habitual kind of response. They get activated spontaneously, unintentionally, to the point that people aren't aware that they get activated. And that sets up an interesting predicament for those people. Their values tell them to respond one way, and these spontaneous reactions set them up to actually violate their values.
Talking to Patricia Devine, professor of psychology, director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison, about unintended bias, race, gender stereotypes, and how we can overcome them. Patricia, when you're working with people in the lab, and they're taking one of these tests, are they unpleasantly surprised sometimes by the results they get?
Absolutely. I mean, they're taken aback because a lot of people say, I'm not racist. I'm not biased. I actually believe in egalitarianism. And then they take one of these tests and it reveals to them that they possess the associations. They're in their minds, but they disavow them. And so it's unsettling. And one of the things that we try to do is to help people to understand that those associations, they learn them in a rather ordinary way through socialization experiences, in their developmental experience, and that having those associations doesn't make them bad, mean, evil in any way. It just makes them actually rather ordinary. And so then there is the predicament, though. Your values tell you one thing. These responses set you up for failure.
We've been learning these responses, as you say, from a very early age. We've been building them up for years. That said, is it possible to unlearn them?
I think that it's possible to overcome them. I'm not sure if it's possible to unlearn them. I mean, so for example, I disavow gender bias, race bias, and a lot of other types of biases, but I could generate instantaneously what the stereotypes are, right? So I know I shouldn't act based on the stereotypes, but it's not as though my awareness or my knowledge of those stereotypes just goes away. So I think the challenge is to become tuned into when it is that you're most likely to think in stereotypic ways so that you could mark that event, you could pause, you could reflect, and you could generate other responses. And that's what we've been trying to do, is to develop an intervention that helps people to understand how prejudice can be a habit-like response, a habit of mind, and that those habits can lead to outcomes that they disavow, would rather not occur, and then to kind of create a concern about discrimination. And once those pieces are in place, they're educated about those things, we teach them strategies that they could take from our intervention, whether it's a workshop or, you know, some other format, and they could take those strategies into their everyday lives and practice them to try to overcome their biases.
Give us an example of what those strategies might be.
Well, one strategy would be perspective taking. Just taking a few moments to reflect on the experience of those who have historically and are in a continuing way stigmatized by their group identity. So taking a few moments to think about what it would be like in the STEM context to have your abilities called into question simply because you're a woman. It's not because of anything you've done. It's just by virtue of your group membership, or to be thought of as a terrorist because you are Muslim, or to be thought of as hostile and aggressive because of the color of your skin, because you're a black person and not because of anything that you've done. It turns out when people take a few moments to think about that, they start to think, that's not fair. I wouldn't want that to happen to me. And that they want to try to remedy this type of, they get empathic. They start to be concerned about the other. So that's one strategy. If people do this, just simply think about these things, it slows them down. They start to think about what kinds of responses they would rather have. So that's one strategy.
Is it that easy to do? Because I think, okay, I'm a white male. Can I really think that I can get inside somebody's head with one of these different perspectives that I haven't lived myself?
I think that people can learn that. For example, if you start to seek out additional contact with people who are from stigmatized groups, right? So maybe get more interaction with women in leadership positions or African Americans that you've not had that experience before. If you start to get to know people, that can feed into your ability to take their perspective, right? So that's a second tool, seeking out contact. Stereotype replacement is another strategy. When you start to be able to tune into when it is that stereotypes are most likely to pop to mind, what we say is that you detect it, you reflect about it, you reject it, and then you can replace it with a type of response that is more congenial to your values.
Psychology professor Patricia Devine is with us now from the UW Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab. We're talking about her research into conscious and unconscious, unintentional bias and stereotypes and how people can learn to hopefully overcome them.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about her work on bias and stereotypes? Do you think we as a society are improving over time when it comes to prejudice based on race? Have you recognized a bias maybe that you have, and were you able to change that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking right now about prejudice, bias, and stereotypes, and a UW-Madison project that aims to help people overcome them. Patricia Devine is with us. She's a psychology professor and director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, comments, and maybe experiences. Have you caught yourself having that kind of reflexive bias against a person, against a group of people? Maybe based on race, gender, or other characteristics, whether you wanted to have that reaction or not. Did you do something to try to get past it? And how pervasive do you think bias and prejudice are? And are we getting better over time? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Patricia, I wanted to ask, you do these interventions, you work with people in the lab. Does it stick around? Do these improvements stay with them over time?
We found that they do, and so that's the encouraging news. We've had the opportunity to look at the impact of our interventions over relatively short windows of time, on the order of 3 days, 2 months, 3 months, but also out to 2 years. And so one of the really important outcomes of our work is that when they go through our intervention, we see increases in the extent to which people become concerned about discrimination as a social problem. And I think that's a pivotal lever, if you will. Once you switch that lever, then they really want to know how to fix it. And they learn the strategies. These experiences stick with them. And then we see even 2 years later, people are more willing to challenge bias when others make bias statements. Or in our work with faculty, so you were saying in the lab, we've done some work in the field mm-hmm. with the STEM faculty here at the University of Wisconsin. And what we found is that 2 years after our intervention, departments that had been offered the intervention compared to control departments were more likely to hire women faculty members. And the main problem in the STEM discipline, if it is the underrepresentation of women, hiring more women would be a benefit.
Let's go to our callers now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had an experience growing up with bias. My family was of Austrian descent, and everyone spoke that dialect. And I remember them clearly speaking about negatively about Jewish and African American populations. And then I started dating someone who grew up completely differently and was not taught or did not overhear negative comments. And I just remember being in a room at a dance where we were the only white people, and I was just totally uncomfortable, and the person I was dating didn't think anything of it. And so that really kind of opened my eyes a little bit to what I had been experiencing as a child, listening to my relatives speaking negatively.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. And sometimes I guess cues are subtle. In this case, these were not subtle cues that Elizabeth was getting growing up.
Right. And I think there was the sort of stark contrast in your experience that could set you up for that kind of relative comfort versus the discomfort. The discomfort can be kind of instructive in some ways. And when people start to think that, well, maybe there's not a reason to be uncomfortable, it prompts people to think more about these issues and maybe sets them on the path to trying to address them.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. And along those lines, are there ways to raise kids, educate kids that don't reinforce stereotypes that might have been around for centuries?
That's a great question. I mean, everybody's interested in the idea if we could intervene early, if we could prevent kids from learning those associations, then we would perhaps be more equipped to solve the problem. The real challenge is that the stereotypes are embedded into the very fabric of our culture. If you look at our media and you look at the kind of information that that children are exposed to, the real challenge is they learn them before we really have that opportunity to teach them what might be acceptable or unacceptable. And so that's challenging. With Kristen Schutz, who's a collaborator of mine in the department and one of our graduate students, Catherine Scott, we are trying to do some work where we intervene with parents to try to help them work with their kids to address bias. And we find that parents may be important contributors to the overall socialization experiences. But when children respond with bias, the parents are often mortified. And they're thinking, why would my child do this? And they can feel uncomfortable about that. And that may be a motivating factor that would lead them to try to figure out, work with us to develop strategies to work with their kids.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Scott on the line in Portage. Scott, hi.
Hi, great. Thank you for taking my call. It's a good topic. I like this. My question is your study, is it based on all races and sexes and religions? I noticed in the last few years that I'm a white male, middle-aged, blue eyes, and automatically I'm accused of, I can feel it and hear it all around me, that I'm accused of being a homophobe, xenophobe, and all those other phobias. And honestly, I feel I'm not. I mean, but I don't think I am. And I was just curious, is it that broad of a spectrum?
Scott, thanks for the call. So are you working just with, as Scott describes himself, average white people, or are you looking for prejudice, bias from anyone?
We've done a lot of work where we looked at prejudice of white people toward black men, toward women, actually women toward women too. But I think it's actually important to broaden the consideration, because it's not the it's not only white people or men who are likely to be biased toward different groups. The concern, was it Scott? Was that his name? That Scott raised. I mean, I think it's really important that we're not taking necessarily accusatory tones, right? If people, because people can feel threatened, and then they want to withdraw from opportunities to interact with other people. And the reality is, a lot of the biases that we see, as I said before, are rather ordinary. There are these kind of habit kinds of reactions. And I think if people understand that problem, they may be more understanding of their own internal experience, and they may understand better the experience of others.
Scott, thanks for calling in. We're talking about unintentional bias, how we can spot it and overcome it. Patricia Devine is with us. She's director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison. She's been working on these issues for some decades now. These obviously are sensitive issues, and as you say, it's easy for someone to become, in effect, defensive about it. How do you bring people whether in the lab or out in the field, how do you bring people into the process in a way that they're willing to participate and hear what you're saying?
Well, I think one of the things is to really understand that these associations learned, I guess I could say, innocently, right? I mean, by being socialized into the culture. And to be very clear, that doesn't make a person bad. That doesn't make a person, you know, mean or evil, as I said before, but understanding the ordinariness of that type of bias against what people understand to be their values, I think it sets people up to recognize that the inconsistency doesn't suggest that they are racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever the group might be, but that they have this conflict, this internal conflict between what their values say and what the stereotypes suggest.
Do we know, is there research into, you know, our level of unintended bias and these reactions and overtly racist behavior? Does one necessarily lead to another?
No. In fact, I think among many people who would show these unintended biases on the overt level, they would never display those biases. They would not intentionally discriminate. Now, I don't want to be naive to suggest that there aren't people who will intentionally discriminate, because there are. We've done some work on the motive to express prejudice, as well as the motives to respond without prejudice. And there are people who are intentionally hostile toward different groups. And the kind of intervention work that I've done, I don't think would be terribly effective with those people. I think that's a different entry point where you have to, provide different experiences that might lead people to question their current way of thinking.
As we mentioned at the outset, issues of race and other forms of bias are big parts of our national conversation. They're in the news all the time. From your perspective, doing the work that you do, what would you like to see us say differently in the media as we cover issues related to bias?
That's a great question. If we could control the media, it would be amazing. If we could alter the kind of images and messages that are provided to people. But I think if we could at least encourage people to consider alternative notions, you know, that encourage people to stop and think that when the media presents a message, it's not the answer. It's an image. Right. I mean, think about advertising. It appears that women love to do housework and they, you know, focus on all of those kinds of things. And many women do and they love it. And many women don't. You just at least encourage people to consider the alternative and to recognize the way in which biased processing or stereotyping, for example, can constrain the opportunities that would be available for people who are members of stigmatized groups.
We'll leave it there for now. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
We've been talking to Patricia Devine. She's a professor of psychology and director of the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab at UW-Madison. A conversation's done on the air, but you can keep sharing your thoughts and maybe your experiences. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. By the way, while you're at the Central Time Facebook page, we have a link to an article about the work that Patricia Tricia and her lab, the Prejudice and Intergroup Relations Lab, do. That was published in The Atlantic magazine. Some more information there about that. So again, head over, share your thoughts, your experiences, and read some more about Patricia's work. That's at the Central Time Facebook page. And as always, tweet us at Central Time WPR and follow what we're doing here. Check out archived audio at WPR.org.
If you're a pet owner, you might have some clothing or maybe accessories for your dog or your cat, maybe a collar, maybe a sweater for a cold Wisconsin winter, or maybe an adorable hat for a funny picture that you want to post on social media. But one thing your pet probably doesn't have, samurai armor.
A company in Japan called Samurai Age has been making samurai-style armor for people, more for, I think, a fashion statement than actual protection.
And now they've branched out with a line of samurai armor for dogs and for cats. Naturally, we have pictures, and you can check them out on the Central Time Facebook page.
They're adorable, and I followed up in a high point in my broadcasting career with an online search for medieval armor for dogs. And yeah, that exists too. A company named Organic Armor has been making medieval, kind of fantasy-style armor for dogs for over a decade now, and various craftspeople on Etsy and other sites have their own pet armor projects, too. So, Veronica, you have dog companions in your household. Will they be armored in the near future?
They will not be armored. I have to admit, I have a slight aversion to dressing up any animal in human clothing, which reaches its zenith of uncomfortableness for me. Discomfort is probably a better word. When you dress up chimpanzees in human clothes, like overalls.
Yeah.
That's over the top. Now, these dogs are pretty cute, but I'm still not going to go out and buy them armor.
I've yet to meet a cat that would let me put armor on it, too. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.